The consequences of the Muslim world's ignoring of the declaration of the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation, OIC, to observe August 21st, the anniversary of the sacrilegious arson attack at Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969, as World Mosque Day, have become obvious today, with the despicable Zionists feeling emboldened in the further desecration of Islam's third holiest site. Recently, on the 53rd anniversary of that tragic arson attack, gangs of armed Zionists, encouraged by their alliance with the reactionary Arab regimes, stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque to hold Talmudic rituals, even as the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, issued a statement apprising the Ummah of dire situation in Beit al-Muqaddas. The Islamic Republic of Iran, which decades earlier had initiated the move at the OIC, observed, as usual, the World Mosque Day to denounce the Zionist regime's crimes against humanity and reaffirm support for the oppressed people of the Zionist usurped land of Palestine. Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, as well as Yemen's Ansarullah, led government in Sana'a, also observed the World Mosque Day and renewed their allegiance to the Palestinian defenders to help liberate Al-Aqsa from Zionist occupation. But most of the Muslim countries were mute, with only some non-governmental organizations commemorating the anniversary of the tragedy. As for reactionary Arab regimes sitting in the lap of U.S. along with their newfound Zionist cousins, the reports from occupied Palestine failed to arouse whatever is left of their Muslims' conscience and were viewed as mere amusement. The recent spectacle of the godless gangs trampling the sacred compound of the Haram al-Sharif with their boots on was a shock to the local Muslims as well as to the Palestinian Christians who recently lost their prominent journalist Shirin Abu Aghle to a bullet from an Israeli regime troop and who in 1969 had joined their Islamic compatriots in dousing the flames of the arson attack despite the hurdles thrown in the way by Israeli regime troops. In Tehran, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson tweeted, "Resistance is the sole way to save Palestine, and Al-Aqsa Mosque and all mosques across the globe will remain the center of anti-Zionist resistance until the full liberation of Palestine." The Hamas statement from Gaza read, "The occupied city of Beit al-Muqaddas, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is the core of the Palestinian struggle against Israeli occupation deliberate attacks. We reiterate that we will keep defending it with all means possible, including comprehensive resistance until liberation and return." It added, "The crime of burning the blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque and Israeli occupation and Zionist aggressors' ongoing crimes against our land, our people, and our holy sites will not break the Palestinian people's determination to stand against Israeli crimes, but rather would ignite the flame of resistance and make us firmly adhere to our legitimate rights until liberation and return home." In 1969, on August 21st, Australian Zionist Dennis Michael Rohan had sneaked into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and set fire to the 800-year-old wooden ivory pulpit, which was badly burnt, along with the southeastern ceiling, as were the ornamental mosaics and two marble pillars between the dome and the mihrab. The fire also burned the altar of Prophet Zachariah and the place of worship of 40 other prophets, damaging an area of nearly 1,500 square meters. Both Muslim and Christian Palestinians joined ranks and rushed to douse the flames, but Israeli regime forces prevented their entry. After short but fierce clashes, they made their way into the sacred sanctuary and started to tackle the fire. After the fire extinguishers failed to work, they looked for sources of water but found the pumps broken and the hoses cut by the Zionists. The Muslim and Christians then quickly banded together to form a human chain and used buckets and other small containers to bring water to the building. The UN Security Council, which on September 15, 1969, passed Resolution 271 under pressure from Muslim countries to condemn the Zionist regime by 11 votes to none with 4 abstentions, made mention of previous resolutions regarding the Geneva Conventions and the occupation status of Beit al-Muqaddas, but had done nothing concrete. Today, on the dictates of the US and European regimes, the world body has long stopped even its toothless verbal condemnation of the Zionist regime's desecration of Islamic sanctities. The result has been growing acts of blasphemy by the Zionists, who are now in an unholy alliance with the treacherous Arab regimes, which have no regard for the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Thus, as Iran, Palestinians, and the rest of the Islamic Resistance forces insist, because of the rejection of a peaceful solution to the chronic question by the so-called defenders of democracy, armed struggle is the only way for liberation of Al-Aqsa Mosque and Beit al-Muqaddas. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Today, we're examining a little-known process that's being used to build support for the Zionist regime. I was shocked to recently discover that Jewish children in the UK as young as 4 or 5, are being encouraged to support Zionism, the official racist ideology of the Israeli regime. Later in the show, I'll be speaking to experts about this unethical practice to find out more. But first, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation into how Zionist groups are trying to indoctrinate Jewish youngsters to support the racist ideology of Zionism.
In occupied Palestine, the resistance faces the Zionist entity daily. It faces the military, the settler movement, a racist political system, and cruel state bureaucracy. These institutions depend on support from outside the Zionist entity. The Zionist movement is engaged in long-term planning to build that support. This is a process of turning young Jews outside Palestine into partisans of Zionism. It is a process of grooming young people to radicalize them. This is a real threat to national security in every country that the strategy is used. It educates, trains, and prepares young Jews to have a primary loyalty to the Zionist entity and encourages them to commit, practically, to the racist state ideology of the entity, Zionism. How does this work? The most obvious way is by funding many thousands of young Jews from age 18 to 32 to go on free propaganda tours to the Zionist entity, so-called birthright tours, or the Israel Experience tours for 16 to 18-year-olds. In reality, no Jew living in the UK or US has any birthright to the land of Palestine. But this racist settler colonial narrative is openly advertised by Zionist groups, including the most mainstream Zionist groups like the United Jewish Israel Appeal in the UK, the largest Zionist fundraising group. Less obvious are the radicalization processes adopted for children at much younger ages. In fact, indoctrination starts as young as 4 or 5 years old when children begin primary school. The UJIA refers to their approach as building a lifelong connection to Israel. They begin by school exchanges with Israel, aiming to normalize the Zionist entity. This is not just directed at Jewish kids, but also at non-Jews in comprehensive education settings, for example, in Glasgow. There is even a special program to infiltrate Israeli citizens into British settings, including primary and secondary schools. Survey respondents overwhelmingly agreed that these agents of a hostile foreign power enhanced connection to Israel, understanding of Israel, and knowledge of its history. But it's not just external Zionist groups. Some schools are themselves openly committed to promoting the racist ideology of Zionism. For instance, the Hartsmere Jewish Primary School in North London says it is Zionist, and nearby Yavna College in Elstree, North London, advertised itself as a religious Zionist school under the heading Me and My Land. But British Jewish children have no right to the so-called Land of Israel. They boast of inviting extremist Zionist groups to indoctrinate the pupils, including Mizrahi UK and Stand With Us. They are taught how to be a positive advocate for Israel. The penetration of British society by the racist Zionist movement is not accomplished by just external lobby groups, but is integrated into the structure of British society, beginning in primary schools.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Tony Greenstein. Tony's a long-standing anti-Zionist activist and a founding member of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. He's a prolific blogger and a veteran opponent of fascism. He wrote A History of Fighting Fascism in Brighton and the South Coast, and he's about to publish a new book titled Zionism During the Holocaust. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. I mean, are Zionist groups really trying to indoctrinate primary school kids?
Yes, they are. I mean, this United Jewish Israel Appeal, the biggest Zionist fundraiser in this country, is engaged with this, what it's called, this Lifetime Connections Program, which starts from 4 to 11 in primary schools. They're active in a school in Glasgow, which is a non-denominational school, but which has quite a large number of Jewish students in it. And they bring in their pro-Israel stuff to that school to Jewish and non-Jewish kids. So they're proselytizing about Zionism to British kids in general. So it's extraordinary. I mean, they're... We wouldn't be allowed to do this if it was Palestine or if it was any other issue of political conflict. But in this case, it seems to be accepted without question.
Mm. Tony, what's your experience of indoctrination into Zionism? Do you have any sort of personal experience of that?
Well, I went to a Jewish school, the King David School in Liverpool, from the age of 11 onwards. And yes, the Zionist Federation and the various institutions had a stranglehold on the school. I mean, they had a shaliach, that is an emissary, an overseas emissary from Israel, who was a teacher there. And there were other Israeli teachers who came and went. But yes, the whole atmosphere was about support for Zionism. It was taken for granted. We never heard even the word Palestinian. This is back in the 60s, of course, but the Palestinians were just Arabs, and all we knew was that they just didn't want to make peace with Israel for some strange reason.
Yeah, indeed. So it was really like a process of indoctrination then.
Oh, yeah, socialisation and indoctrination, yes. I mean, my experience, I mean, one of the reasons I broke from Zionism early was the headmaster, who was bitterly criticised, decided to have a debate in the school debating society on Zionism, right or wrong, and I played the devil's advocate.
Right.
And in the process of researching the talk, I found out that all the stuff I'd been taught and learnt was a myth.
Right, interesting, yeah. I wonder how many other young Jewish kids go through a similar journey as you, Tony, but well done for certainly doing that. But David, I mean, tell us a bit more about this Hartsmere Primary School and Yavne College that were mentioned in the film, and what's the connection between the EHRC, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, and to Bristol University as well?
Well, these two schools are governed in common. There's a woman called Rebecca Hilsenrath, who you might remember this, Chris, at the time of the complaint about the Labour Party to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, that she was the chief executive officer, and she was in charge of the complaint for some months before she recused herself. So she's the governor of these schools, which describe themselves, self-describe, as Zionists. So that's an extraordinary state of affairs in itself, and should really have disqualified her from any involvement with the Labour Party complaint from the very beginning. But she only recused herself sometime later, and for nebulous and very, very unclear reasons. So that's the first connection. The second connection is that the president of the Bristol Jewish Society, a student society, when they took the complaint against me back in 2019, well, she went to Yavne College. So in my own case, we see the process of indoctrination. They come out of these schools, they then take leading roles in Jewish societies and universities. They go on to take national roles, which this particular person did. She became the president of the Union of Jewish Students, and then off they go into politics to pursue Zionism for the rest of their political careers. So this is an ongoing process. It starts, yes, in primary school, but it goes all the way through. There's a whole process of indoctrination all the way through till they're adults.
Tony, tell us a bit more about this Birthright organisation. I mean, are they really suggesting that all Jews have a birthright to the land in Palestine?
Oh, absolutely. That is the myth that Zionism is founded on, that the Jews were expelled from Palestine in 2000, at the time of Christ, which is not
2000
correct.
2,000 years ago, yeah.
2,000 years ago, yes. And that they are now returning. Of course, it's a complete nonsense. I mean, you can't claim to return to a place after 2,000 years. In any case, there is no connection between... I mean, Judaism sees Jerusalem as the centre of its religion, but it's a religious connection. There's no biological, genetic or any other racial connection whatsoever. In fact, the direct descendants of the ancient Hebrews are the Palestinians who lived there, and Ben-Gurion accepted that.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting. Yeah, the Zionists kind of passionately making this case that somehow this kind of 2,000-year heritage is just really curious, isn't it?
Well, if they came across the ancient Hebrew tribesmen today, they would be shot on sight as terrorists.
Indeed.
I mean, that's the irony. It's a racial myth, nothing more.
No, indeed. But David, I mean, some of these schools are boasting, aren't they, that they're bringing extremist groups into the classroom, including assets of the Zionist regime. I mean, how do they get away with this?
Well, it's curious, isn't it? I mean, one of the organisations we saw there was Stand With Us, which is an organisation which was set up and took money from the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Its UK branch is funded entirely by its US branch, which came out of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs anti-BDS work. So this is effectively an agent or an asset of a hostile foreign power of the State of Israel, which is brought into schools to give talks as if they're somehow politically neutral. They're clearly not politically neutral. They have a particular take on the question and should be nowhere near schools except in the context of debate.
Mm. Does Ofsted have anything to say about this kind of thing?
They don't appear to know. I mean, you might recall last May when there was the attack on Gaza and on Al-Aqsa Mosque, that there was a letter from the Education Secretary saying that schools shouldn't be having discussions about Palestine, and if they were to have discussions about Palestine, they should use these particular three organisations, which he listed, all of which, of course, it turned out, were Zionist organisations. So they actually don't see this as a problem at all. These Zionist organisations go into schools anyhow, and then whenever anyone talks about the Middle East, we can't have a pro-Palestinian organisation, we can't have any organisation criticising Zionism, we can only have Zionist organisations as if they give a balanced debate, which, of course, they don't.
Mm, it's an incredibly partial position that they take, isn't it?
Especially given it's not just in secondary schools where kids are sort of starting to learn
Indeed.
Questions about political debate, but at primary school, as if this is just common sense.
Sure.
And it's not common sense. No, this is a highly partial set of arguments which pursue the foreign policy objectives of a hostile foreign state, and they're taken in schools as if they're just unexceptional.
We'd think the minimum that would give students, the opportunity to hear, another version, if you like, of the truth. But Tony, just before we go to the break and the next video, I mean, some Jewish communal and religious institutions are actually explicitly signed up to Zionism, aren't they?
Well, most of them are. The organised communal organisations, like the Board of Deputies, the Jewish Leadership Council and so on, have in their constitutions support for Israel. Mm. So that therefore means they defend Israel, right or wrong.
Sure.
And so in the context of education, you get brought up to believe that in 1948, the Palestinians ran away to let the Arab armies in. That they voluntarily left. In fact, we were told that the Zionists begged them to stay, but they wouldn't.
Has their support for Zionism always been a feature of Jewish communal and religious organisations in this country?
Oh, no. I mean, when Zionism first came to Britain, the Jewish bourgeoisie, including the chief rabbi, Sir Hermann Adler, they opposed it vehemently as being opposed to the Jewish religion.
Yeah.
They said it was a secular heresy.
Sure.
But, of course, when the British ruling class adopted Zionism, the Jewish leaders fell into line slowly but surely.
Yeah.
But no, most Jews at the beginning of the 20th century, they saw Zionism as really a form of Jewish anti-Semitism.
There's been a real shift. Well, let's just pause there for a moment anyway. Report about how Zionist indoctrination seems to have given rise to a peculiarly racist brand of comedy.
The very significant investment in indoctrination made by the Zionist movement, including by the United Jewish Israel Appeal, the main UK fundraising body for ethnic cleansing in Palestine, has clear impact. The investment in scores of organisations for young people, youth and young adults works its way through the society and props up the racist ideology of Zionism and legitimises ethnic cleansing in Palestine. But it also schools and coaches young Jews in wider racist ideas and ideologies. How does this work out when they grow up? Take the example of a school in North London, the Haberdashers' Axe School, now known more simply as Haberdashers. Significant number of nationally and internationally known entertainers attended the school, including Matt Lucas and Ashley Blaker, who are behind the popular comedy show Little Britain. David Baddiel, the stand-up comedian and key participant in the anti-Semitism smears against the left over the past 5 years. Perhaps best known is Sacha Baron Cohen, who made his name blacking up as a young Muslim, Ali G, pretending to be black, and then played a series of other Muslim comedy characters, including Borat, in the internationally known film of the same name. Work produced by all four has regularly been condemned for racism. Little Britain was widely criticized this year as racist when some old shows were made available for streaming again. After George Floyd was murdered, the shows were pulled from Netflix. Baddiel famously blacked up and taunted the black football player, Jason Lee, in a series of primetime comedy shows. Lee later said that Baddiel had never properly apologized for the damage he did. Baron Cohen has been widely criticized for decades for the racism of his portrayal of Muslim characters. It has been said that the school might be the origin of these creative talents, often referred to in the media as the Elstree School of Comedy. But many of those involved, such as Baddiel and Baron Cohen, also credit a little-known Zionist youth group, Habodim Dror, as playing a role in their success. Socialist Zionist group, Habodim Dror, is one of the many Zionist youth groups financially supported by the UJIA. According to press reports, it's had an extraordinary track record as a hothouse which produced significant figures in the arts and entertainment industry. Perhaps it should be known as the Habodim School for Racist Comedy.
David, tell us a bit more about the school that changed its name to remove the reference to a slave owner.
So Haberdashers asks, it's not a Jewish school, it's an elite private school, very expensive to go to if you want to send your kids there. I'm not going to tell you how much because you'll
It's a lot.
It's a lot. And it's produced a huge number of people from the some from politics, but from arts and entertainment. We listed a few of them in the film there, but there's tons more. And they also have a functioning Jewish society at the school. And the president of the Jewish society at the school before he came to the University of Bristol was a guy called Edward Isaacs, who became the president of the Jewish society in Bristol University. So another connection here. So, but the people who've gone there, including Matt Lucas and Ashley Blaker, who are behind Little Britain, many of them have returned to appearances at the school as old boys, alumni, that kind of thing. Mm. And it's said, the press says, so many people from the entertainment world have come from this school, it's a sort of school for entertainment. Well, actually, what was interesting, I think, in looking at this film was the way in which many of the people who were involved there were also in this Habonim Dror, the Zionist organization. And so it's a kind of curious thing that they've kind of produced this school of comedy, which would appear to have some kind of affinity with racism. You can't see that. Not necessarily a direct connection, but there's some kind of curious thing going on there.
Mm. I mean, Tony, it seems rather odd to me, anyway, that this Habonim Dror, which claims to be a socialist Zionist youth group, produce this kind of racist comedy. Does it seem odd to you?
No, not in the slightest. There is really no such thing as socialism.
Well, I should have said socialist Zionism.
Yeah, you can be a socialist, you can be a Zionist, you can't be both at the same time. But no, not at all. The socialist Zionists, or the left Labour Zionists in Palestine historically, were more racist than the right-wing Zionists, because the right-wing Zionists would employ Palestinians as cheap labour. Mm. The Labour Zionists wanted to exclude them entirely. Mm. So left and right in Zionism is really meaningless. And it doesn't surprise me that the racist caricatures of Arabs comes from the left Zionists primarily, and that's what David Baddiel, who blacks up and who finds it funny to imitate the hair of black people and so on. Jason Lee, the footballer, who he mimicked and persecuted really.
They did.
But Baddiel is a particularly horrific racist, but he still appears on British television.
Oh, he does.
Keir Starmer's favourite Jew.
Absolutely. a very sort of prominent Zionist advocate, as far as I can see. But, I mean, David, this I see that the United Jewish Israel appeal was mentioned in our reports. I mean, what's its role in all of this?
So, we've mentioned it several times. This is the biggest Zionist fundraising organization in the country, and it's part of in Israel, it's part of the national institutions. There are four national institutions which make up the head of the Zionist movement, and the EJIA in Israel, called Keren Hesod, is a key part of that, and it raises funds for the occupation of Palestine, for settler colonialism in Palestine. Mm. And it's not really known about in this country. I mean, people do know, I think, a little bit about the Jewish National Fund, which was involved in expropriating land in Palestine. But the UJIA is the biggest of the organizations. It's coming for really very little criticism. And it's involved in funding all of these youth organizations we've been looking at and many other organizations, including funding some of the schools we've been talking about, the Zionist schools. This is an attempt to indoctrinate the entire society with pro-Israel narratives, and yet it escapes almost all criticism and scrutiny. So I'm really saying we should be looking at more and much more at this organization. It's headed by almost all of the key fundraisers for the Zionist movement in this country, names which some of which you will know, and it should be really in the crosshairs of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, in addition to other organizations like the JNF.
No, indeed. Well, we've shone a bit of a light on it today, yes, obviously we need to do more. But, I mean, Tony, in addition to Habonim Dror, there's quite a variety of Zionist youth groups, aren't there? I mean, what can you say about them?
Well, they all support a Jewish state, which means a Jewish supremacist state, so they will differ on tactics. I mean, there's the right-wing one historically was Betar of Herut, now Likud. And in the 1930s, it's young people trained with Mussolini forces in Civitavecchia, the naval port in Italy, and then transferred to the Polish fascists after Mussolini allied with Hitler. But I was a member of B'nai Akiva, which is the religious Zionist group. And before 1967, they weren't particularly nationalist. I mean, they were more religious. But after 1967, with the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, they moved to the far right. They became the Messianic Jews who believed that God wouldn't come back until they'd conquered every inch of Palestinian territory and expelled the Palestinians or made them into slaves. That's a condition on which they can stay. So, yes, I mean... But they're all the same. I mean,
the process of it seems to me, anyway, from what you're saying, a kind of process of indoctrination is seems to be kind of endemic with these organisations.
Yes, I mean, you're socialised into it. You accept Zionism as a norm.
And quite difficult to sort
the
of
Arab
work out
is the other. You don't really discuss them. They're invisible. But
sure.
For all colonialism, the indigenous population was invisible.
No, indeed. I mean, David, is there a kind of old boys network going on here where, you know, you get sort of former members of Zionist youth groups kind of helping each other out in later life? Is that how it works?
Well, you can see that in some of the meetings that are held at the Habs Boys School where the old boys come back and they give them advice on careers and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But also it would appear that they do this through careers. I mean, in the BBC, for example, there's a guy called Dan Patterson, both from Habs Boys and from Habanim Dror, who did Mock the Week. And Badil says in an interview somewhere in the papers that in his early days he would come along to these meetings to be commissioned to write jokes. And Dan Patterson said at the end, Bitorum, which is the dismissed statement that you would get at the end of the Habanim Dror meetings. And he realised that he was a former Habo and that he could get in there and to discuss things with him. So according to Badil's own account, there's a sort of elective affinity there that people, they help each other out through later careers. And this is how Zionist ideas are replicated in adult life.
Sure. It really is like an old boys network then from what you're saying. But Tony, what do you make of the allegations of racism that's been made against the likes of David Badil and others? I mean, you think is it fair to link that to Zionism? From what David's saying, it certainly does seem fair. I mean, what's your thoughts?
Yes, because black people and Arabs really are the untermention in a sense. So Badil started his career blacking up as a black person and then making himself into the object of a joke, I mean, which he transferred to people like Jason Lee, the famous footballer.
Yes, he did.
And I think other comedians have done likewise who are Zionists as well. Sacha Baron Cohen, for example, also blacking up. So, yes, I mean, this was a staple of musical comedy in Britain. And America in the 30s and the 40s. And again, it had racist roots in the Deep South. So, I mean, that's the tradition they come from. But if you think of Israel today, it's a replica of the Deep South in it with its Jim Crow laws. I mean, if you're a Palestinian, you can't live in most of Israel. It's barred, you know. Yeah. Hundreds of Jewish communities are Jewish only.
Well, listen, I'm afraid we are out of time. Thank you, Tony, for joining us today and giving us the benefit of your knowledge. And obviously, thanks again to David, our resident expert. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini continued his struggles against the Pahlavi regime, even in exile in Iraq. It was also said that, due to the pressures of the regime, the Imam asked his wife to return to Iran, but she rejected and didn't leave her husband alone. Today, you will hear the events after the demise of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa. Stay tuned, please. The suspicious death of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, was one of the bitter events during his exile in Iraq. This was not just due to the son and father relation and love. As a matter of fact, the Imam always praised his son's scientific and spiritual position so that he said on his death, Mustafa was the future hope of Islam. The Imam's wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, says on the event, On Sunday, 1st of Aban, we had not got up when the Imam came to us and called Ahmad and said that someone has telephoned from Mustafa's house and asked for help. He told Ahmad to go and see if Ma'sume needed help. Ma'sume, Mustafa's wife, had stomachache the night before, and the Imam knew it. Ahmad immediately went to his brother's home. I got up too and went to Mustafa's home. There was a car at the door, which went away instantly. I ran after the car and saw that it entered the hospital. The doorkeeper didn't let me in and asked who I was. I said that I was with the patient. He said in cold blood that he had already died. The Imam's wife continues, Hearing the news of Mustafa's death from the doorkeeper made me impatient, and I fell on the ground. As he saw me, he asked, What is your relation with him? I answered, I am his mother. Then he allowed me in, and I understood that I had lost my dear son Mustafa. I don't know how I got back home. I cried nearly till the evening when the Imam came to Mustafa's home. Upon seeing him, I lost my patience and said, Do you see what has happened? He told me, Be patient for God's sake. I know that it is hard, but if you consider it for the God's sake, it will be easy to tolerate. God will make it easy to tolerate this disaster. I said, I cannot, sir. I have endured much hardship, but I cannot endure this one. The Imam put his hands on his wife's shoulder and said, I know, but be patient for God's sake. Imam Khomeini's wife was very sad at Haj Aqa Mustafa's suspicious demise. Moreover, she was worried about the Imam's health, as he was seriously under spiritual pressure at the event. After the death of the Imam's elder son, women would come to the Imam's home for extending condolences. But the imam's wife was worried about answering the questions of the visitors, as some of them were the members of the Shah Intelligence Service, SAVAK, or the Iraqi Intelligence Service, to get information from the imam's home. The body of Haji Agha Mustafa was buried the day after. Although Imam Khomeini was very sad at the event, he said that his death was one of the hidden favors of God. The news of Haji Agha Mustafa's death soon spread across Iran, and all seminaries in Qom, Mashhad, Isfahan, Shiraz, and Tabriz were closed. Thus, the name of Imam Khomeini could be heard again after 13 years of prohibition. This ignited people's sentiments, and some of the preachers likened Imam Khomeini to Prophet Abraham, as he had passed through divine tests successfully and patiently. Mourning ceremonies were held throughout the country until the 40th day of Haji Agha Mustafa's death. These ceremonies were indeed good opportunities for political protest against the regime. After the 40th day, Imam Khomeini wrote three letters in response to those who had condoled with him. He had written in the letters that, "Although Mustafa's death is very bitter, it is not comparable with the calamities and oppressions that the regime enforces on the people." Imam Khomeini's answer to the condolences of great ulema was indeed a political protest against the Shah. It soon was spread among people and angered the regime. The Shah used to keep silent toward the reports of SAVAK, but as he read the imam's statement, he got very angry and ordered several articles to be published in response to the statement. Thus, the article, "Iran and the Red and Black Colonialism," was published on Etelaat newspaper with the pen name of Rashidi Mutlaq. The article had insulted Imam Khomeini, and it kindled people's hatred against the regime. Seminaries were closed, and the seminary students gathered at the homes of the sources of emulation. Therefore, Qom was the scene of popular protest rallies, which led to the martyrdom of a very few people by security forces. This infuriated the people in various cities and led to the formation of demonstrations in chain 40th days, which resulted in the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the social and political crisis in France. But first, this brief analysis.
France has been experiencing social and political crises of various forms for at least the last 10 years. But one would be hard-pressed to know this from watching Western mainstream media. Only when the French state began to brutally suppress the continuously held yellow vest protests, including the deployment of the French military to the streets of all major cities, and the use of munitions, resulting in the loss of eyes and limbs among protesters, did many realize the gravity of the situation. EU-mandated austerity policies imposed by the two traditional political parties in their respective administrations, following France's cult-like commitment to European integration embodied in the Lisbon Treaty of 2009, resulted in the collapse of the two-party dominant system of socialists and Gaullists, which had existed in France since the 1960s,
a system which created a reasonable level of political representation for the poor and working class in the French state. The far-right nationalist currents and parties gained many disgruntled voters from both sides, and out of this mess emerges a wondrous media gestalt with minimum qualifications, called Emmanuel Macron, supported and sponsored by the French billionaire elite to be crowned the youngest president in French history. Macron was made leader of a new neoliberal political organization that continues where the two older parties failed the EU to forcefully implement all the EU-mandated austerity measures. When confronted by opposition in the French parliament, the young president rules by the significant decree powers that the constitution of the Fifth French Republic grants the president. In this process, dismantling the French social welfare state, which had been the basis of social stability in France since World War II. There is an ominous contradiction between the positive image of France that's portrayed in the billionaire-owned media and the negative reality on the ground among the average population. A reality which occasionally rips through the fake media imagery when Macron is slapped, booed, or pelted with rotten fruits when he's forced to step out among the rabble during election seasons. There doesn't seem to be a political party or movement currently in France who's offering solutions to the basic historic and structural problems that France is facing. Media propaganda, rule by decree, and when necessary, sending the military into the streets are the methods of rule that the French elite and oligarchy have chosen in the last years in order to forcefully end the French social welfare state, contrary to the wishes of the overwhelming majority of French citizens. The Fifth French Republic is itself the result of the social, political, and economic upheaval that France experienced in the 1960s following the loss of its empire and the devastating Algerian War of Independence. It remains to be seen if the Fifth Republic will end in social turmoil and upheaval just as it began.
Author and journalist Ramin Mazahedi, thank you for joining us on Insight. We want to have a nice conversation about France and what's going on in France. You've been there for many years now as the Press TV journalist. You've also recently written a book about the Yellow Vest movement, which was a social movement there in France, which I was hoping that you could maybe also talk about that a little bit and all the events that are happening in France. Let me begin our conversation maybe with this introduction. We see that France is basically going through a very long period of turmoil, of political instability, which, you know, obviously when you have this kind of political instability, it's probably rooted in some sort of a social and economic instability. We see that the two main political orientations of parties, the Gaullists, the Socialists, which were dominant in the Fifth French Republic, and we can also talk about historically the different republics that have existed. We see that, you know, since at least 2017, with the coming of Emmanuel Macron, that these kind of political parties and movements, the traditional ones, have also kind of changed. There's new movements. There's the kind of so-called centrist movement that Emmanuel Macron, who was at one point part of the Socialist Party, entered the politics with that movement. We see the rise or the reinvigoration of the nationalist movement under Marine Le Pen, who is the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen. So there's a lot of things going on in France. And as somebody who spent a lot of time there and who studied it deeply, we would want you to, in this program, maybe give us some of your own insight into what's going on in France. So what's going on in France?
Well, like you said, I mean, I've been there for 13 years, and I have a certain point of view that's unique to the daily hard news reporter. I think this is what our listeners can kind of benefit from. It's great to have academics. It's great to have think tanks. It's great to have different types. So the Daily Hard News is sort of, it's a different perspective because every day you're looking at the news and you have to make a decision that day. You have to make a judgment on, was this policy good? Is this policy working? This bill, is it working? Did this politician deliver on what he just said?
Right.
And, yeah, to go back to your main point, I can tell you from on the ground reporting, you know, you were talking about the two mainstream parties in France. They are totally smashed. They are totally discredited with the average person. Mm-hmm. It's over. It's right. Finished for the Socialist Party. It's finished for the Gaullist Party in whatever form, you know, you right. want to call them. Sarkozy, Macron. Macron, as you know, being a centrist, that is smashed as well. Right. He was never a centrist. He was always a right-wing politician. Mm-hmm. He was a Gaullist minus the love for France, minus the patriotism. And that's basically what the two mainstream parties have become. They are no longer pro-France parties. They are pro-EU parties. Mm-hmm. This is something that I think many people don't understand, and many people don't understand in France, and even the Yellow Vests don't understand. And that's this concept that since 2009, since the forced installation of the Lisbon Treaty, mm-hmm. which became a part of the very foundation of foundational texts of the EU, of the Pan-European project, Europe has drastically changed. Mm-hmm. We are talking about very, very different things. It's a brand new era across Europe in France. And what that means, and even the Yellow Vests, who are so politically intelligent, they don't understand this. France, this guy right here, Macron, does not have control over his currency, over France's budget, over France's skies, over France's rails. So many things. Right. It's a brand new Europe. And the Yellow Vests provide a sort of capstone to the end of the era of European social democracy. The EU is the assassin of social democratic measures. The idea that, well, we don't want socialist central planning, we don't want socialist total equality, but we do want social security, we do want some, you know, unemployment insurance. That this era, it was called in France the 30 glorious years from 1945 to 1975. Mm-hmm. That is what in Europe, what neoliberalism is trying to end. That's what the EU is there for. And what I can, you know, to just go back to what I was saying about how being a daily hard news journalist on the ground, the benefit it has is I can report the Yellow Vests were only 15-20% worse in terms of how they were repressed than in 2016, 2014, 2010. There has just been, since 2009, you know, as my book shows, as it relates, the Pan-European project has totally failed to bring prosperity, democracy, and stability. And the Yellow Vests are the outgrowth of that. And we can focus on Macron, but Francois Hollande, his right. predecessor, was just as bad. Sarkozy was just
as bad. Because we have to remind our viewers, he was the industry minister. Emmanuel Macron was the industry minister Hollande, and Hollande was a socialist.
Right.
And we see all across Europe this idea that these socialist parties, who traditionally were supportive of the working class, we don't want to exaggerate, but as you said,
particularly
after World War II, in most European countries, the working class, those who are, you know, workers or lower level employees, there was a level of political representation that they had within the political system of Europe.
Limited, but there.
But there was there. And the basic standard of living was they were capable of maintaining that basic standard of living, and maybe even a little bit higher than that in terms of education, in terms of social mobility, all those things that are considered, you know, positive things.
Leading among the world, yeah, you know, but in the European social safety
net. All that has gone now in Europe.
It's all gone. It's all gone.
In all countries that you look around Europe, those socialist parties basically became neoliberal parties in the 90s.
Right.
Whether it was in Austria, whether it was in Germany, whether it was in Britain with Tony Blair. And
that's when it became totally confirmed. In France, it was with François Mitterrand's U-turn, his infamous U-turn, elected in 81 on the most leftist program in West European history,
exactly.
83 U-turn, and it's the way that, and my book talks about this, the way that French elites have been captured by neoliberalism, but the average person has not.
Exactly.
And that's unlike in the U.S., in the U.K. The average French person is committed to ideals of egalitarianism, certain reductions on individualism, and they protested in mass numbers in 95. And then everybody in Europe starting in 2009, every spring was an anti-austerity protest.
Exactly.
So the rest of Europe kind of, caught up with France. But we see with the Yellow Vests how the French are always taking it further. They are so politically enlightened, and we are going back to 1789. I'm not trying to, put them on a higher level. But you look at 1789 and the way that it fought against monarchy, autocracy, oligarchy, aristocracy, and then liberalism, the way that liberalism has failed in two centuries of French history, and we see it now with the European Union, the way that Western liberal democracy has failed to bring what they were asking for in 1789, egalitarianism, equality, fraternity. Just as monarchy has failed, so Western liberalism has failed. Mm-hmm. And the Yellow Vests, God bless them, they don't really understand this. The idea that the Pan-European project has failed. So they had a list of 42 different demands that...
The Yellow Vests.
The Yellow Vests. Not one of them mentioned Europe. Not one of them...
So let me see if I understood you correctly. So we have a couple things that are happening at the same time. We have this giving away of national sovereignty under the title of European integration.
Yes.
So basically every country we see now after this process happened in the late 90s in many other countries, mm-hmm. And then, as you mentioned, culminated in the Lisbon Treaty.
Precisely.
We have most countries regretting that, most of the population of many of the countries, not the elites, regretting that they gave away that sovereignty in the name of European integration. Now, we have to go back and also mention that at that time, when the issue of European integration was happening, the main argument was, well, we have a history of war in Europe, so let's give that nationalist sovereignty, let's give away some of that, and we will have this peaceful, lovely Europe where it's all one and we're all together.
Yeah.
But ended up happening is you had basically the tools being taken away from national governments to make social and economic policy that is relevant.
Precisely.
So
we are relying on Brussels to be social democratic.
Which they're obviously not going to do.
They're obviously not.
So we have this one movement. I'm trying to just summarize what I heard from what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, we have this idea that those traditional left-wing socialist social democratic parties, which were supposed to represent the interests of normal working class people, they had that neoliberal turn, as you said. Mm-hmm. You mentioned France. We could also mention Austria in the 80s. The Social Democratic Party being run by a banker. We could talk about then later on Gerhard Schröder in Germany with the Hartz and the Hartz IV, the program to cut Social Security. We could talk about Tony Blair, of course. So we have all this.
All over the West, like what you're saying.
Right.
I mean, we can go through every country and point out all over the West, which was never a revolutionary culture, almost never. I mean, France was 1789, but they didn't succeed. It's not a place like Iran. It's not a place like China. It's not a place like Cuba. It's not like Eastern Europe.
Right.
Western Europe and the Anglophone countries, it never took hold. Elitism has dominated. Liberalism, which is basically just aristocracy, rights for those who can afford it. Yeah, I mean,
I was going to say is that then what ends up happening is a lot of these working class, they start voting for right-wing nationalist parties.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have a situation, because we talked about the idea that in France we have a kind of a withering away of those two main orientations, the Gaullists,
which, totally discredited.
The so-called mainstream conservatives,
totally.
and the mainstream socialists. You suddenly see a huge rise in the nationalist parties in France, in different countries. So if you could talk about that a little bit too, the idea that you have this working class feeling... I'm not talking about all of them, mm-hmm. but the idea that you have significant portions of the working class who used to vote for socialist parties suddenly now voting for nationalist parties, with the idea of immigration and migration and all those, hot topic issues being raised for being exploited in terms of electoral power.
Who's making this a hot topic? I mean, in France, in between the presidential election of this year and the legislative election, the biggest news was the Burkini, a